How was that for some light Christmas reading? It's Christmas season. Good morning, everybody. this morning we're going to start a three-week Christmas series. We're taking a break from the book of Revelation, and we're going to enter into the Advent and Christmas season beginning this morning. And we're going to do it a little differently than we sometimes do. Normally, we just celebrate the fact of Jesus coming to earth, and we look at the gospel stories of Mary and Joseph and the wise men and Herod, and we just celebrate the fact of his coming. But this season, we're going to ask the question, why? Not just the fact that he came, but why did he come? Why did Jesus come? What was his purpose in coming? In his own words, why did he come? And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to find places in the gospel where he explicitly says, this is why I came. This is why the Son of Man came. And full disclosure, I did this 4 years ago. You won't remember the series. But I asked the question of John's gospel. In John's gospel, where are there places where Jesus says, this is why I came? And so we looked at three different things he says. This year, we're going to look at Matthew's gospel. According to Matthew's gospel, and it just so happens that there are exactly three places, at least that I could find, where Jesus explicitly says, this is why I came. And what was also interesting, I hadn't anticipated this, each one of them, he says, I came not for this reason, but for this reason. So let me just show you the three that we'll be looking at for the next couple weeks. First one today, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. Another one, I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And then the final one, the Son of Man, sometimes he refers himself in the third person, which he's the only person who can get away with that, really. But the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So this morning, we're going to look at that first one that you just heard Terry read. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. And I'll just, my disclaimer up front, when you ask that question as a teacher, what does Jesus say? The bummer about being a teacher is you're stuck with the answers, okay? And I'll just, honestly, this is not the message I want to preach this Christmas season, what Jesus has to say today. It doesn't feel Christmassy, but if you're going to ask the question and have integrity, you have to go with the answers. If he had given four answers, I would have kept this one out and had the other three, but there's only three that I could find. So just full disclosure, this is a difficult, Jesus says some difficult things in this passage, and yet ultimately he says some great things. And so as we enter into this Advent season, we want to be asking the question, what does it mean to be followers of a Jesus who says, this is why I came? And so that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at what he says and ask, what does this mean for us this Christmas season? What does this mean for us, for our lives in general? Little context, chapter 10, Jesus sends out his 12 disciples into the towns of Israel, and he basically sends them out on a short-term mission trip. And his message is, go and preach the good news of the kingdom. Preach the good news that I have come, and don't just preach it, but demonstrate it. He gives them authority to cast out demons, to heal people. He says, go out and preach the message. And then what he says is, as you do that, you're going to receive a very mixed response from people. Some people will receive you, some people won't. And in fact, some of the responses will be even hostile. And as you read all of chapter 10, you get a sense that Jesus isn't just talking about what's going to happen on this short-term mission trip, but he's talking about what's going to happen for the next 40 or 50 years after he's raised from the dead and these men go out and preach the gospel. And even beyond that, what's been happening for 2,000 years. And you get this very mixed response. So that's the context of these words that we see in verse 34. So two main ideas I want to share. And again, I'm going to try to keep it pretty short this morning. Two ideas Jesus shares this morning for us. First, the inevitable division that results when he comes. The inevitable division that results when he comes. And then second, the utter devotion that he requires of his followers, okay? So first, let's look at it in his own words, this utter division that results. Verse 34, Jesus says, don't suppose that I have come to bring peace. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. Now, In the Christmas season, peace is on our lips regularly, right? Some of your Christmas cards say peace. And the angels actually say in the Christmas story, peace on earth, right? And so it feels very strange to hear Jesus actually explicitly say, I didn't come to bring peace. And in one sense, we know ultimately he did come to bring peace, right? He came to bring peace between humanity and God and to reconcile us to our Father. So in an ultimate sense, he did. But here he's saying, in an immediate sense, my coming does not bring peace on earth. In fact, just the opposite. I have come to bring a sword. Now, last time I checked, a sword is not a very peaceful image, right? And I don't think he's mainly thinking literally that I've come to bring, war, though that sometimes results. But the sword is a metaphor for division, okay? Swords cut things in two and divide. In fact, if you read Luke's version of the story, Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring division. That's the word he uses. He's saying, my presence is going to divide people. It's going to split people up. That's the inevitable result of me coming to earth. There will be division. And he goes on in verse 35 to say something really hard, I think, which is this division will even cut through the closest human bonds. Take a look. Verse 35, for I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be members of his own household. It says the division between people is not just a national division or an ethnic division. This is a division that's going to run through even the closest human ties. And all we have to do is look at the history of Israel in the next 40 years after Jesus says this, and those words absolutely came true. If you look at Israel in like AD, 5 AD versus 70 AD, it's a radically different place. This man entered into the situation and there was a splitting of people. And that splitting even happened in families. Certain, children were ostracized from the families because they accepted Jesus. It broke up, it created conflict in marriages. It broke up families. Absolutely, historically took place. And of course, 2,000 years later, his presence continues to do that. It continues to divide people. And so he says it right up front. Don't suppose that my presence is going to bring peace. He says that because we'd be tempted to suppose that, right? Because when we look at Jesus, we see a man who is so loving, so gracious, so kind. He's a healer. He loves humanity. You'd think, what could be so divisive about someone like that? And so he says, don't suppose that my presence is going to bring peace between people. It's not. It's going to create division. There's something about me that is polarizing. Which, of course, are you still with me? Yeah. Okay. Which, of course, begs the question, what is so divisive about this man who is so loving and gracious and kind and compassionate? What is so polarizing about him? And there's actually several correct answers to that question. But based off of this passage, I would say it's the second point I want to bring up. You know what is so divisive? It is the utter devotion that he demands from people. It's the exclusive 100% commitment that he requires of people. And let me read it again. Look at what he goes on to say in verse 37. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves a son or daughter, parents, hear this one. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me, not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Okay? That's what's so darn divisive about this man. Verse 37, he's saying, I want you to think of your closest relationships. Think of your closest human ties. And he's saying, you have to love me more than that. Your kids, your spouse, your best friends. You have to prioritize me over them. They cannot get in the way of you following me. And then he goes on in verse 38 to even say, even your very life, your desire to protect and guard and keep your life safe, even that can't get in the way of following me. I have to come first. The utter devotion that he demands of his followers. I don't care how kind and considerate and compassionate you are. You say that, that is incredibly polarizing. That's incredibly divisive. I was listening to a message from Tim Keller recently about the exclusive claims Jesus makes, and I love Keller. He is a very winsome preacher in our culture. But kind of to this point, he says, Jesus is different from any other religious or spiritual teacher in all of history. He says, if you take any other great spiritual teacher, people we would have heard of down through the ages, whether Buddhist or Jewish or even other Christian teachers, Muslim, Hindu, any of them, all the greats, their teaching is always very self-effacing, okay? What I mean, and they may have been prideful people themselves, but their actual teaching, they're always pointing people away from themselves, okay? They're always saying, hey, I'm not the truth. I'm just a guide, right? I can point you to the truth, okay? But I'm not asking for commitment to me. Don't commit yourself to me. Commit yourself to the way of life that I'm talking about. I'm not the issue here. What I have to say, that's what I want to point you to. Jesus is the only famous spiritual teacher that constantly puts himself at the center of the conversation and says, no, I am the center of this conversation. There's other people that have done that in history. You've never heard of any of them because we all say they're crazy, right? But he's the only one who does this. I was thinking of what he says in John, well-known statements that Jesus makes. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. He said, I'm not here to point you to the light. I am the light. I am the light. How about another I am? I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm not saying, let me show you the way. I'm saying, I am the way. Let me show you the truth. No, I am the truth. One more. I am the vine. You are the branches. You need to depend on me. And then he says something really offensive. Apart from me, you can do nothing, right? Constantly putting himself in the center of the conversation and saying, what you think of me is all that matters. That's what's most important. In Matthew's gospel, later on, he's going to ask the disciples a question. They've been with him for a while, and he says, who do people say that I am? And they answer, and then he looks at them, and remember what he says, and you guys, who do you say that I am? He says, I want to pause, and what do you think of me? And Keller, in his really winsome way, he says, imagine if you had any other friend or spouse who was like that, who continued to draw attention to themselves. What if you went out on a first date, and you're talking for 5 minutes, and then 5 minutes into the conversation, the person across the table says, but enough about you. This is Keller's joke. I'm not taking. Let's talk about me. You'd say, you're crazy, right? Jesus is the only spiritual teacher that makes those kinds of audacious claims. Constantly putting himself at the center of the conversation, making himself the issue, and in our passage today, demanding 100% complete allegiance to him, not just to his way of teaching for his followers. I want to look a little bit more closely at verse 37 and 38. So take a look again and spend a little bit more time in these verses. First one, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. I was thinking about these verses, and I think there's two postures that he's calling us to in this. One, there's something to embrace, and then there's something to let go of, if I can put it that way. And it's kind of obvious. But the thing that he's calling us to embrace is, of course, himself. He's talking about, I want you to love me. I want you to cherish me. I want you to follow me. I want you to be committed to me. I want you to embrace me and following me wholeheartedly. Okay? There's the embrace. And then within that, of course, there is a letting go that needs to happen. So you know that love and that devotion and commitment you have to your kids or to your spouse or to your friends or to whatever close relationship, you have to hold that a bit loosely in the sense, and of course those are great commitments, Jesus would say, but in the sense that those your devotion to that person can never get in the way of your devotion to me. They can never be put in between you and me. You can never prioritize them over your relationship with me. And so there is a necessary holding loosely to those relationships in comparison to how you fully embrace your commitment and relationship to me. None of those people can ever be allowed to get in the way of our relationship. Now, doesn't that feel offensive? I mean, we've heard this before, but he's saying, you have to love me more than your kids. You have to love me more than your spouse. You have to love me more than your closest friends. It almost feels wrong to hear someone say that. And of course, we could add other things beyond just our closest relationships. Our deepest commitments, I think Jesus would say the same thing of, you've got to love me more than your career. You can never let your career and your pursuits in your career to get in the way of our relationship. Now, you've got to love me more than your financial security. I've got to be more important than having a financially secure future. You've got to love me more than your desire to be in control of your life. You've got to love me more than your desire for comfort and safety. You name it. Whatever it is, I have to be first. 100% devotion. That's what I'm asking for. An undivided heart. And then he even takes it a step further. If we're not already feeling a little offended here, verse 38, he really goes in for the jugular. Very well-known verse. He says this many times in his ministry. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Now he's saying, not just your closest relationships, but you gotta love me even more than your own life. You know that natural desire you have to guard and keep and protect your life and your own interests and your own hopes for the future? Even that, you gotta let go of. In fact, what he's saying is, you gotta crucify that if you wanna follow me. And again, I see these two postures. There's an embrace that he's calling us to, and there's a letting go that he's calling us to. Take a look at the verse again. Take a look at verse 38. Here's the embrace. He says, follow me. That's what I want you to hold on to. Follow me. Wherever I lead you, go. Be with me. Where I go, you go. That's what I want you to grab onto 100% in your life. And with that, of course, there is this letting go. There is this surrender. And here, the way he says that is in the first part of the verse, take up your cross. Now, what does that mean? We've heard this many times. He's saying, I want you to take up your cross. That's something you have to do if you want to follow me. Okay? What does that mean to take up our cross? We have to remember that in the first century, there is nothing spiritual about a cross. Okay? No one's wearing crosses on their necklaces and on their ears. There's no spiritual connotation to cross when Jesus says this. A cross only means one thing. A cross is a first century Roman Empire execution tool, right? A cross is something you put criminals on. That's the only thing it means in Jesus' day. And criminals, and Jesus had to do this, you know, oftentimes they had to actually carry their own cross to the place of their execution. So take up your cross is an image of, it means nothing other than death. It's an image of execution and death. And Jesus is essentially saying that. If you want to follow me, you've got to live as though you're already dead. you have to crucify that part of you that just wants to live for your own interests and for your own safeties. And I think he means it in two ways. One, I think he means in an ultimate sense you have to do that. You have to decide, if I'm going to follow Jesus, that might lead to ultimately me literally dying. It's possible that if I follow Jesus, I might get killed for it. And you think about the 12 guys he's talking to in this passage, probably 10 of the 12 of them did actually lose their lives because of this decision to follow him. So in an ultimate sense, he's saying, you got to come to realize that's what might happen. And then I think in a daily sense, he's saying, every day, you got to take up your cross. Every day, you got to make that decision to say, I know I've got this natural desire to protect and guard and secure my own interests, but if I'm going to follow Jesus, I got to die to that. I got to surrender that. I got to let that go so that he alone can be my priority. And what struck me this week, I never thought about, is I would have thought Jesus would say, if you follow me, you may end up having to take up a cross. But that's not what he says. He says, no, take up a cross and follow me. He says, taking up a cross is actually a prerequisite to follow me. That has to happen on the front end. That's the first thing that needs to happen if you are actually going to be able to follow me. You have to make that decision to die to these other things in comparison to your devotion to me. Pretty radical. I was trying to think, what would be a modern day parallel to this? And I don't know if this will work or not, but I'm watching for the first time, and Carrie's watching with me, Band of Brothers. Have you guys ever seen that as a miniseries, Band of Brothers, about World War II and Easy Company, this American, you know, group of their paratroopers who parachute down behind enemy lines in Normandy on D-Day. And I'm in episode 3. And episode 3 kind of chronicles the story of this guy named Private Blythe. And this guy just panics. He just freaks out. I mean, he parachutes down, and he drops in, and he lands in this ditch, and he just freaks out. And he doesn't leave the ditch, and he just stays there, and he's crying, and fighting going on around him. Finally, the Americans secure the place, and he doesn't come out until it's all done. And he just panics, and he freezes, and he actually goes blind. He has like a psychosomatic blindness that takes place, and he just can't handle the stress, the thought of what might happen, and so he just panics. And there's this conversation that he has with one of the captains, and I don't think the captain's necessarily a hero, but he gives this perspective that is going to sound morbid, but I actually think it's pretty close to what Jesus says. Here's the conversation. This is Captain Spears says to him, "You know why you hid in that ditch, Blythe?" Blythe says, "Yeah, I was scared." And the captain says, "We're all scared. You hid in that ditch, listen to this, because you think there's still hope. But Blythe, the only hope you have is to accept the fact that you are already dead. And the sooner you accept that, the sooner you'll be able to function as a soldier's supposed to function. All war depends on it." Okay, not very, little morbid, but he's basically saying, hey, you got to come to terms with the fact you're probably going to die. And the sooner you come to terms with that, the better you can perform your role as a soldier. Now again, that captain, he's not a hero by any means in this. But I think there's something similar to what Jesus is saying to his disciples 2,000 years earlier. He's saying, if you want to follow me, the sooner you can accept that death is a possibility, not just someone killing you, but every day that you're going to have to die to your own interests, your own devotions, so that you can be devoted to me. The sooner you can do that, the better. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. His famous line in that book is this: when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Come and die to this desire to hold on and to protect and to preserve your life in the here and now so that you can embrace this call to follow me. Of course, the point is not dying. The point is following Jesus Christ. So that's the second point. Not just the inevitable division, but the utter devotion he demands. And all this, what he's saying is, I want to be first. I want to be your first priority, your first love, your first treasure, your first commitment. I don't want anything getting in the way of you and me. Take up your cross and follow me. That is why I came. I came to be your king, so that you would give your allegiance to me. I came to be your light. I came to be your bread. I came to be your truth. I came to be your vine that you depend on every moment. So how are we feeling right now? Good? Good. I think there's something incredibly hopeful about this. But heavy stuff, especially on Christmas. I wanted to get this one out of the way first. The next two will be a lot lighter and more fun. I would love to do some PR for Jesus right now. I would love to soften the edges of this a little bit and make this a little more palatable. But I think faithfully, I want to also just present Jesus as he is and present his words as they are. I remember a chapel speaker back when I was in college years ago, and he had this great metaphor for what we're tempted to do with Jesus now, 2,000 years later, which is to soften what he says. And he said, I think the church today is in danger. We're in danger of inoculating ourselves with Jesus. And this is what he meant. You know, we're in flu season right now. I'm curious, actually. I've never got a flu shot. How many of you are flu shot getters? Okay. Oh, you're less than 50. That's surprising. Okay. Well, you know, a flu shot, I don't understand how this works so well, but a flu shot or inoculations, you know, what are you doing? You're essentially getting, you're getting a very small dose, a very small and weak dose of the flu so that you don't get the real thing, right? That's what an inoculation is. And this chapel speaker was saying, the danger for us is that we get inoculated with Jesus 2,000 years later, that we get a weaker dose of him, just enough of him, that we think we've got the real thing, but it actually inoculates us from ever hearing the real Jesus as he presents himself and his words as they're presented, which is to say we're tempted to soften him and make him something other than he was so that it fits the lives that we want to live. And so it's important for us just to sit with who he was and what he actually said. So here's the question for us today. What does this mean for us? What does this mean for Christmas? What does this mean for us this Christmas season? What does this mean for our lives in general? And essentially, just to simplify this, to me it's this. Jesus is saying to us, hey, I want to be the one non-negotiable in your life. If I could just put it in layman's terms, that's what he's saying. There's a lot of negotiables. I want to be your one non-negotiable in life. And I want to bring this to Christmas. And to do that, I want to talk about Thanksgiving for a second. A couple weeks ago, as a staff, we were thinking about Thanksgiving, and this was kind of last minute, and we're thinking, who are some people in our community who maybe don't have a place to go for Thanksgiving? And so we were throwing it out. And what we realized, it was so hard for a lot of us to last minute invite someone to Thanksgiving because we have this tradition of Thanksgiving, right? Well, this is where I get to be with my family, and this we have this thing that we do, and it feels kind of awkward to try to bring someone else into that, or in some cases there were practical reasons why I'm not hosting Thanksgiving, so it feels really weird as a non-host to try to bring someone into that, and those are reasons that make perfect sense. But as we reflected on it this week, in light of this passage, and as I reflected on it, I realized we all had for Thanksgiving, there were some non-negotiables to our Thanksgiving, right? And this is how we think, like, these are the givens. This is what will happen for Thanksgiving. And oftentimes it's family, turkey, this time with us. And then there's negotiables. And in this case, it's, well, if we can bring someone into that, great. If that doesn't feel right, that's a negotiable. And I thought that, again, there's valid reasons why we didn't do that. But isn't that how we so often approach Christmas season? That we let the culture frame the non-negotiables of Christmas and what Christmas has to look like. And it might be different for each one of us. But, you've got your non-negotiables. For some of you, Christmas tree, non-negotiable, right? We will this season, if you haven't already, we will get a Christmas tree. Christmas lights, there might be certain parties that you attend every year. Certainly making sure the presents are covered and all of that is a non-negotiable, oftentimes a vacation. And then some Christmas Eve or Christmas morning with a certain group of people, you've got these non-negotiables, right? These are givens. This will happen. And then as good Christians, we ask the question, how can we bring as much spiritual content into those non-negotiables as possible? So let's do a Christmas devotional with our family this year, right? It's a negotiable. But that would be a good thing to do. Or some of us, we think of serving the poor and needy during Christmas time. And so, let's look for something that we could do as a family. Or maybe it's inviting someone, involving someone into that. But we start with a set of non-negotiables. And then we ask, how can we maybe bring some things into that? Is that making sense? And that's how I do Christmas. And I thought, that's a pretty good metaphor for how we do life in general. And here's what we do, is we start with a set of cultural non-negotiables to our lives. And then we ask the question, how much can I bring Jesus into those non-negotiables? So let me just throw out a couple. It could be, I mentioned career earlier. Maybe it's career advancement. Okay? That is a non-negotiable. So from when I'm 25 to when I'm 65 or whatever, a non-negotiable, as I'm going to advance in my career, I'm going to take on more and more responsibility, more and more money. That is That is a given to how I'm going to pursue life, okay? Getting married, having a family, could be a non-negotiable. Finding a home in a safe neighborhood that's going to be good for this family, that's a non-negotiable. What else? Having kids that are very well educated, those could be non-negotiables. I could fill this in, and we say, given that framework, how can we then bring as much Jesus into that as possible? And as I read this week, I thought, I don't think that's the way Jesus intended us to live our lives. And what would it even look like? And I don't even know. So I'm right here with this. What would it look like to reverse that equation and to say, Jesus, you are the one non-negotiable of my life. You're the only given. Following you as best I can, being in relationship with you, pleasing you, loving you, being devoted to you, that is the one non-negotiable. Everything else is negotiable. Everything else needs to fit into that. Career advancement? Negotiable. I sure hope it happens, but that's negotiable. More important is discerning what you want to do with my time and what you want me to do with my life. My reputation around here with coworkers or with neighbors or with friends, that's negotiable. I would love that. But it's not as important as doing what you want me to do with my life. Time in front of the TV. Negotiable, right? That would be great. I like time in front of the TV. Time in your word. Learning about you. Being devoted to you. Non-negotiable. Just flipping that. Money. Saving for a great vacation. Awesome. And totally negotiable. Using my money to invest in your kingdom, giving of my first fruits to you, and whatever you call me to, non-negotiable. What would it look like to flip that equation? To say to Jesus, you are my non-negotiable. And I'll leave you with this. How is that ever going to happen in our lives? As I sit with, I look at my life, I am so far from that. I am so far from that. How is that change ever going to happen? Well, it's not going to happen by guilt and shame. And if you're feeling like, oh, I'm so far from that, and you're tempted towards guilt and shame, and I'm gonna make this thing happen, it's never going to work. I promise. Tried it. Doesn't work. It's going to happen by revival. I mean, that's the only way it's going to happen. And what I mean by revival, the Spirit of God has to blow in our lives and in our hearts and move in us so that we are increasingly convinced that Jesus is the best thing in the world, that there is nothing that compares to him. And that's going to look different for each one of us, but there's two things I want to leave you with that I think the Spirit has to convince us of, okay? And I get it from this passage. Two things if we're going to start moving so that he is our non-negotiable. First, the Spirit has to do work in our hearts to convince us that there is no other love in the universe like Jesus' love for us. Nothing. There's no love for us that compares to Jesus' love for us. And I want to take you back to verse 38. Jesus says, take up your cross for my sake. And what we have to be convinced of is that he is not asking us to do something for him that he hasn't already done for us. We have to see in that call, that call comes from someone who has already taken up his cross for our sake, who has already given his life for us, who has already said to us, you are my non-negotiable. You were my non-negotiable. I said, loving you, saving you, protecting you, that was my non-negotiable. You know what the negotiables were? My comfort, my safety, my very life, my reputation. I lost all of that because I was devoted to you, and I continue to be devoted to you. I love you. I am committed to you. And I'm asking you to be committed to me. And we have to just be increasingly convinced of that love. And only the Spirit of God can convince us of that love. And then the second, the last thing I'd say is the Spirit has to convince us not only that there is no other love like Jesus, but there is no, and this is going to sound funny, there is no other viable option to what he gives us in this passage. There is no other reasonable way to live. And again, this has to come from the Spirit. Here, let me tell you what I mean. Look at verse 39. I love this. Jesus says, whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. What is he saying? He's saying, you can try to find your life. You can try to keep your life safe. You can try to protect your future and your security and all that. You live that way, you will lose your life for all eternity. Or you can let go of that. You can hand that all over to me. You can give your life over to me. And if you do that, you will find your life for all eternity. Giving your life fully into my hands, if you do that, your life could never be safer than if you do that. It is the only reasonable thing to do. It looks crazy, it looks radical, it looks dramatic, but when you consider eternity, it is the only viable option for you. It is the only safe bet that you have in the world. But the Spirit of God has to convince us of that. So that as we give our lives to Jesus, we don't actually think we're doing anything particularly radical. We just think, this is the only reasonable thing to do, all things considered. There's a story of a man who was a farmer. And one day he was walking, he passed his property, walked into another field, and he's walking, and he bumps up against some metal object on the ground, and he digs it up. And it's this metal box, and inside there's like $5 million in it. A lot more money than he has. And he stumbles upon this, and it's probably left there from some previous landowner like 50 years ago. And so what he does, you guys know the story? He goes and he sells his house, he sells his car, he sells his tractors, he sells everything he owns, which adds up to about 300 grand, so that he can buy the plot of land where this treasure is, and he buys the plot of land. And with that purchase, he has this $5 million treasure. And his friends don't know about the treasure. And so they look at his life and they say, you are so crazy. What were you thinking? That was such a foolish decision. And the guy just looks at his friends with this knowing smile because he knows that he has not made a sacrifice at all in giving up everything he has. He has done the only reasonable thing there is to do because he knows that he has with that field the greatest treasure in the world. Amen? Let's pray. Well, Lord, as we hear these words of yours calling us to this devotion to you, calling us to let go our hold of our lives so that we might grasp onto you, I pray that your Spirit would move in us, revive our hearts, create in us a fresh hunger for you, that we might see you as the greatest treasure. And that whatever we have to sacrifice to be with you wouldn't feel like a sacrifice because we have our eyes fixed on you. May we do that this Christmas season. May we do that with our lives. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.